It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a new watchdog for prosecutors that some are saying may be a model for the rest of the country.
First, Foxconn and the University of Wisconsin-Madison are forming a new partnership designed to promote engineering and health research.
The company is planning to invest up to $100 million in the UW. The money would go toward a new interdisciplinary research facility for the College of Engineering that would collaborate with the company's proposed plant in Racine County. However, UW would only get that money if it comes up with $100 million in private funds on its own.
Chancellor Rebecca Blank said yesterday that the Foxconn pledge is the largest investment from a research partner in UW history.
We're two very different institutions, but we share a deep commitment to pushing the boundaries of knowledge through interdisciplinary work. This is the type of work that accelerates discovery so that life-changing innovations move more quickly from the lab into the workplace, creating jobs and helping drive Wisconsin's economy.
Foxconn is building a $10 billion facility in Mount Pleasant. It also bought a building in downtown Milwaukee that will serve as its regional headquarters and plans to open innovation centers there, as well as in Green Bay and Eau Claire. The company stands to get $3.5 billion in incentives from the state and about another billion at the local level, provided it creates 13,000 jobs.
Karen Herzog is a higher education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and wrote about this partnership between Foxconn and the UW. Karen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith.
So what's the purpose of this new interdisciplinary facility?
Well, the idea is that university and Foxconn will work together to come up with the innovations that will drive manufacturing into the future. There's always been a conversation about UW system contributing to the economy and to the knowledge base of Wisconsin, and this is what they would consider to be a prime example of that, with the university receiving a large grant like this that obviously they have to match in private gifts as well, but it will put a lot of money into these fast-growing fields.
And the building that is going to be a large part of the cost or the use of this funding, this is a building that's been on the UW's wish list for a while, but on the someday when we might possibly be able to raise the money list, right?
That's right. In fact, this was one of those buildings that the UW saw as being in the queue behind a new chemistry building and a new veterinary science building, and those are both now in the process of the chemistry buildings under construction, and the veterinary science is on its way in the budget cycle. But this was something that they knew they needed a good private donor for, that they needed an infusion of money, and it wasn't something that they saw coming right away. And I think probably the soonest they saw it would be 6 years or so down the road.
And besides this building that would be on the UW-Madison campus, the Foxconn Institute for Research in Science and Technology, or FIRST, would also be established. What is that?
Oh, that's an institute that is basically providing a place for research and development, which companies have that work internally, and sometimes they work with universities to do that. And again, advancing fields, in this case, medical science, material science, things that will become a big part of the future for Foxconn and things that UW-Madison would obviously like to be in the middle of. Now, the institute is mostly going to be located at the Mount Pleasant location in Racine County, where the manufacturing plant will be. But there will also be an off-campus presence in Madison, and off-campus because it is a private enterprise. It's not something that would be part of the university. It would be supported by private money.
One thing that kind of jumped out at me is Chancellor Blank said intellectual property resulting from joint research would be shared between the UW and Foxconn. Karen, do we know how common that kind of arrangement is?
It's an arrangement that is not uncommon. It makes sense that UW would want to hang on to its intellectual property, but obviously if the money to support that research is coming from Foxconn, they have a vested interest in it as well. I've not seen the finer details of this agreement that hasn't been released yet, but it's not an unusual arrangement for them to share this intellectual property that will result from this partnership.
Now, as we said, this Foxconn gift of up to $100 million to UW has to be matched with another $100 million that the UW would raise from private donors. UW has 2 years to raise that money. Do we know what happens if it comes up short? Is it an all or nothing, or is it a dollar for dollar up to that amount?
My understanding is that it's a dollar for dollar up to that amount, and the university hasn't said what would happen if they don't come up with $100 million. But this is not an uncommon arrangement in fundraising. In fact, there was just one a few years ago. Milwaukee money manager Ab Nicholas and his wife pledged $50 million as a matching gift, and the idea was that they would need to raise another $50 million to match that, and they ended up doing it very quickly, and it was a $100 million endowment for scholarships. The idea is that you incentivize giving so that others will step up to the plate, and they can double their gift. If they give $500 because there's a match, it's $1,000 because of the match. So it's a pretty effective strategy in fundraising.
We are talking with Karen Herzog right now. She's a higher education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're digging into the announcement that Foxconn will give $100 million to UW to partner on technology and research. And Karen, a statement from the UW and Foxconn said that the partnership would also focus on research in health-related areas. That's not something we immediately think of Foxconn as being involved with. What's the incentive for them there?
The Foxconn chairman, Gu, has a personal interest in cancer research, and he has expressed this from the very beginning, that he wanted to be partnered with UW because they have the Carbone Cancer Center that does significant research in the genetics of cancer. He lost his first wife to cancer and also a younger brother. So many companies, Taiwanese companies included, are getting into genetic research as part of the future of solving some of the major issues in health in the future.
The response has not been entirely positive to this announcement. Here's a tweet from Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz last night. He said, quote, first they cut $850 million from the UW system. Then they commit as much as $4 billion to Foxconn. Then Foxconn offers a $100 million matching grant to the UW system. When you get played, you don't celebrate it. How much have you been hearing, Karen, about criticism about this arrangement?
I've been hearing a fair amount of criticism. There's a lot of skepticism anytime there's something that comes up with Foxconn. There is a certain amount of skepticism is healthy, because until you see the money, you can't really be sure that it's there. And, of course, this is an election year. Governor Walker was out front on securing Foxconn and all the subsidies for Foxconn to come here. So there are many who believe that this is like a political donation for him, that, you know, okay, well, if you give us $4.5 billion in incentives, well, we'll kick back $100 million to the university, which has had its lots of cutbacks. So you see it on both sides. There are a lot of people who are saying this is great for UW and this is great for research and the economy, and there are others who see it purely as political. So it depends on which side of the spectrum you're on.
And Karen, as we wrap up, they made the big announcement yesterday, and they signed kind of ceremonial papers. But what other approvals, if any, need to be gotten for this to actually be put in place and start rolling?
Well, what they signed yesterday was just basically statements of intent. There was nothing legal about the contracts that were signed yesterday. That will come later, and UW System Board of Regents will also have to sign off on that.
Well, Karen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Karen Herzog is a higher education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked with her about the new partnership between Foxconn and UW-Madison that was announced yesterday. The state of New York is on its way to having the country's first statewide watchdog charged solely with overseeing county prosecutors.
That comes after Governor Andrew Cuomo signed legislation last week that created the State Commission on Prosecutorial Conduct, an 11-member commission that some are saying may be a model for the nation.
Keith Findley is the co-founder and senior advisor for the Wisconsin Innocence Project, a group at the UW Law School that works to exonerate people wrongfully convicted of crimes. Keith, thanks for joining us. us.
Oh, my pleasure.
As it stands right now, outside of this new initiative in New York State, what is oversight like for prosecutors accused of wrongdoing in this country?
Well, the reality is there are several layers of oversight, but none of it is particularly effective. As a general matter, in Wisconsin, prosecutors, elected DAs, are constitutional office holders. So the primary oversight is through the ballot box. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, of course, the work of the prosecutor is not the kind of thing that voters have great insights into. And so usually any kind of problems or wrongdoing escapes the electorate's review, unless it becomes really, really a headline grabber.
Probably close to an election,
yeah.
So memories don't fade.
And beyond that, prosecutors, like every other attorney in the state, is subject to regulation by the Supreme Court's Board of Professional Responsibility Board that polices ethics violations. But again, there's sort of a culture among lawyers not to report one another, and the data that we have nationwide suggests that while prosecutorial misconduct can be a serious problem, it is almost never sanctioned.
Hmm. So this commission would oversee New York's district attorneys, meaning the oversight is only as it relates to criminal cases. Is that correct?
The New York law is primarily about criminal cases. To be honest, I'm not sure if sometimes prosecutors also have some responsibilities for things like termination of parental rights, mm-hmm. child support, things like that, that are not technically criminal. And to the extent that prosecutors are involved in those kinds of cases, theoretically, a board like this or a commission like this could govern that as well.
So some of the details are still being ironed out with the legislation. It was signed into law, but it still needs to be implemented. But in broad strokes, if I'm someone in New York State who thinks the prosecutor in my case has acted improperly, what process is there for me under this law to bring that to the fore?
Under this law, any individual can file a complaint with this new 11-member commission, which then has the authority to engage in full investigations, including the authority to issue subpoenas, hold hearings, do a thorough investigation. And so this is the first example anywhere in the country where there is really a formalized oversight process that is designed to really provide some sort of review of the conduct of prosecutors, an office that otherwise wields massive power. And by the way, I have to make it very clear, most prosecutors are very well-intentioned, have the highest ethical standards, and do very well. But the job is a very difficult one because we ask prosecutors to simultaneously be ministers of justice, whose job is to seek the truth and be fair, while at the same time asking them to be partisan advocates in an adversarial process. And so lapses are bound to happen. And yet there are virtually no real rigorous oversight mechanisms anywhere in the country, except now in New York.
And so if someone does file a complaint and there is an investigation done and the investigation finds that, in fact, there was prosecutorial misconduct, what kind of consequences might that lawyer face?
Well, the consequences can range from everything from a reprimand, a censure, to theoretically a suspension or even removal from office. Now, this commission itself cannot suspend or remove someone from office, but they can recommend to the governor that the governor do so. And New York, just as in Wisconsin, the governor has the constitutional authority to remove any prosecutor from his elected or her elected position.
And we should say that district attorneys are elected, but of course they are not the only one prosecuting cases in a county. There's no physical way they could do that. So their assistant DAs, does this also apply to them? And then I would think maybe the district attorney would have to remove them?
Yes. There are in almost every county in both New York and Wisconsin, there are elected district attorneys, but then also deputy district attorneys or sort of higher level management, and then assistant district attorneys. And the assistant district attorneys, who largely do their work without even considerable oversight by their bosses, can often be fairly young lawyers with not many years under their belt who are making serious decisions about the future of people's lives, and they would be subject to review by this commission as well.
Now, some critics of the plan say that this could lead to anyone looking to get out of a crime to file a complaint with the commission. In your experience, do you think that's something to worry about?
I doubt it. I really don't. For one thing, this commission would have no authority to overturn convictions. That has to go through the courts through the normal appellate and post-conviction review processes. The commission also has the authority to just dismiss complaints if they look frivolous or malicious. So there are enough safeguards in there. I don't see that as a real risk.
We're talking with Keith Findley right now. He's co-founder and senior advisor for the Wisconsin Innocence Project. And we're taking a look at a new initiative in New York State that creates a commission that would oversee and investigate possible cases of prosecutorial misconduct. And Keith, what oversight is there currently, if any, of prosecutors here in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, again, as I said, it's the ballot box, which is sort of a it can be an effective oversight mechanism, but only in the most glaring and egregious cases. It's rarely and it does much good in terms of the more subtle or nuanced examples of prosecutorial misconduct.
I mean, right now there is a recall effort of a DA in Trempealeau County, but that is very unusual.
Very, very unusual. And the governor has the authority to remove any constitutional and statutory authority to remove any prosecutor from office. I don't recall it ever happening. The most recent example where it was under serious consideration was when Governor Doyle was considering removing Winnebago. Ken Kratz,
yes.
Who was made famous for his prosecution of Stephen Avery in Making a Murderer, but he resigned before that process could get going any further. Beyond that, the only real oversight is the state bar's under the supervision of the Wisconsin Supreme Court regulation body for regulating ethics violations that applies to all lawyers across the state. And the discipline rate there is exceedingly low.
You helped to found the Wisconsin Innocence Project. It's a group whose entire purpose is to free people who were wrongly convicted of crimes. Would you advocate for something like this prosecutor watchdog commission here in Wisconsin?
I think it really is a model that the rest of the nation should pay attention to, and one that would serve us well. I don't think it's the solution all by itself. There are other things that can be done as well, including our system would be greatly helped if, for example, prosecutors were required to have written policies on charging and the rules that govern the way their assistant prosecutors handle cases. The legislature has imposed those kind of rules on police departments in various ways, but right now district attorney's offices generally don't. More data keeping could be helpful, but all those in combination with a unified oversight body that really knows what it's doing and has subpoena power and the real ability to dig deep and find what is often very much hidden misconduct could be a very good thing, not only for those people who are wrongly accused, but also for victims of crimes whose cases are being neglected or botched by prosecutors as well.
Some people listening may be thinking that this doesn't affect them if they're not touched by the criminal justice system personally, but I'm guessing there must be a cost to taxpayers when these cases are not being prosecuted correctly.
Well, sure, there are costs associated with the other crimes that the true perpetrators go on to commit when they're not apprehended because we've apprehended the wrong person, or costs associated with crimes committed by people who are no one's ever convicted because the prosecution has not done the job correctly. There are lawsuits that can amount to multi-million dollar payouts. And then there's just trust and confidence in the criminal justice system, which is a very significant matter. And so it's in a democracy, in a free society, to have people wielding serious authority answer to some accountability source is generally a good thing in terms of enhancing trust and confidence in the government.
This is about prosecutors, but especially in your position with the Innocence Project, I wonder what happens if someone doesn't get a good defender, if they have a public defender, for instance, that does not do the job, that is deficient in some way. Are there ways to remedy that situation?
There are doctrines in the law. There's a constitutional doctrine called ineffective assistance of counsel, which provides a remedy If a defense lawyer provides constitutionally deficient representation, a person can try to overturn the conviction on the basis of that. There's also theoretically a system for seeking malpractice damages against incompetent attorneys. Both of those are theoretically available. Both of them are also fairly difficult to invoke, but they, especially the ineffective assistance claims, do work sometimes. But it probably greater attention paid to adequate defense counsel is also an important prescription for improving our system.
And briefly, Keith, as we wrap up, are there other ideas or proposals to oversee prosecutors that you think would be worth paying attention to?
Well, the other ideas I think would be important are the ones that I mentioned just a minute ago about in terms of requiring prosecutors to develop and publish written policies and procedures to govern the vast discretion that assistant district attorneys exercise in our criminal justice system, and requiring them to keep data on charging and sentencing recommendations and things like that, so that we have a basis for actually reviewing what it is in a systematic way, what it is that these prosecutors are doing.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That was Keith Findley, co-founder of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, with us to talk about New York's new commission to oversee prosecutors, which is a first in the country. Grocery shopping is one of those things that must be done, whether you like it or not. But app developers and grocery stores are getting smart about how customers can shop.
Now there are options to shop online and pick up the groceries at the store after someone else has picked all of the items out for you, or you can even have them delivered straight to your home.
These changes are among many that grocery stores are implementing to meet customer demands. Our next guest is here to talk about how grocery stores are evolving.
Valerie Chandna joins us now. She's an assistant professor of management for the Austin E. Coffrin School of Business at UW-Green Bay. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So we are living in a time when you can get your groceries in a myriad of ways. Even in several rural areas of the state, we have online ordering, we have delivery, and of course, you can simply go to the grocery store and do it yourself. But let's look at online ordering. How does that work?
So like you said, there are three major categories you could have. There's what we call the pure play, which is something like an Amazon Fresh. You know, you just go to their website, you order everything, and, you know, it appears in front of your door. And then you've got the click and collect, which is what you're seeing with Walmart, Target, Pick and Save, where you're going through their app, clicking on things that you want, putting it in a cart, and then you just pull up to their curbside and collect those items. And then finally, the third party, which is kind of a mix of the two situations, which is where you've got private shoppers who you're connected with while they're in the store, and then you tell them that, oh, I want my, you know, apples at this ripeness level and my tomatoes to look, you know, red or green or whatever it is that you like. So those are the three major categories that people are sort of using these days.
And it sounds, particularly with the last one, that you have a little bit more control over, you know, what you're getting if you can just dictate it to someone versus maybe going online, picking a menu, saying, I want five apples, and then, you know, hopefully you're going to get what you want. You know, is there a specific group of people that's really, you know, latched on to this?
It is like you'd sort of make the presumption. There is a tendency for younger users to be utilizing these things, people who are more tech savvy, people that are time-starved, essentially, that this is way more convenient for them than spending that 45 minutes to 1 hour in a store shopping. So you do have this tendency of millennials, Generation Z, using these things. But there's also a pull with where there's caregivers or people who have health issues sort of tending to adopt it as well.
Yeah, actually, we had some engagement on Facebook that really does fall into that. Emily says that she used online shopping with pickup when she was on maternity leaves, and she called it, quote, the best thing ever, end quote. And, you know, she went on to say that she didn't have to take her newborn out of the car and into public in the middle of winter or during the flu season. And, you know, she said she was even able to ask someone to pick it up for her when she just couldn't get out of the house. It does seem as though all of these options might be attractive to folks like Emily, who it's not just that they might not have time, but there are all of these other factors playing into whether or not they can do kind of this basic errand.
Right, and I think you do raise a very good point. I mean, if you have mobility issues, this is this could be a game changer for you. You don't have to be reliant on other people and can you know, do some things yourself. The other thing, like you said, you know, when she was unable to pick it up, she actually had Emily had someone else pick it up for her. You know, you could have your teenagers pick your groceries for you. You don't trust them to get the right eggs if you just tell them. But if you put it in the app already, the brown cage free eggs you wanted is exactly what they're going to pick up from the curbside. So it does help.
Yeah, I don't think that my parents would have trusted me at all as a teenager to go pick up the groceries left to my own devices. And a little bit earlier, we were talking about how this seems to have a pretty broad appeal to folks who are millennials, people who are already shopping online, probably. You know, there are numbers out there that, you know, not a huge swath of people, but a sizable amount of millennials are doing this. Is the expectation that it's only going to get bigger as time goes on?
I think that is true, because Gen Z is in the 15 to 20 age group right now and already are reaching the same numbers as millennials, even though they don't have as much cash on them to be spending. They're not the big spenders right now. So there is the tendency to hope that the market is only going to grow. It does stabilize after a point, like and we might talk about this later, but certain countries are seeing widespread adoption, like in South Korea, but now it's sort of tapering off, where it's not growing as rapidly as it initially did. So we might see a huge growth spurt now, but then it might sort of plateau for a little bit.
We are talking to Valerie Chandna right now. She's an assistant professor of management at the UW Green Bay. I mean, she's with us to talk about how online shopping, grocery shopping in particular, is you know, really growing in appeal to people who maybe don't have time, maybe have mobility issues, and other conveniences that grocery stores are offering now. And Valerie, one thing that was interesting to see as we were doing research for this was just how grocery stores in particular have adopted this. It doesn't seem as though they're having to be dragged kicking and screaming to offer these conveniences. You know, how has the grocery store sector really grown to meet this demand?
I think they're sort of trying to make sure that some of the stores that have gone by the wayside, like, you know, Circuit City or Toys R Us, does not become the grocery model. They want to make sure they're anticipating the changes. They want to be prepared for, you know, Amazon's onslaught, which they were anticipating. So I think there's a huge, like you said, they're not being dragged into this. They're doing this willingly. For them, at the end of the day, as long as the bottom line makes sense, they're going to definitely want to adopt this. It's got additional, you know, advantages from their perspective, where they already have these employees who are already stacking things. They can get them to stack a separate section. Unfortunately, some stores are also using robots already. So we do want the people to be employed there, not the robots. But there's a lot of reasons why it makes sense for stores to do this.
That's interesting that you bring up the sort of automation aspect of, you know, grocery delivery and stuff like that, because that is an anxiety that young people have, that they might not have a job moving forward. And this, you know, sometimes with grocery stores is a good entry point into the job market. Have you heard anything from, you know, grocery stores that say this just helps our bottom line by having these robots do it?
I think for some aspects, it does help them. Like I said, the stacking and shelving, yeah, those kind of things. But they still need employees to do like final checks and bring the items to you. So the billing might be done through the automation system, or locating the items in these giant you know, warehouses or sections might be done by some sort of automatic means. But you will have employees who still have to do those entry-level kind of jobs where they bring it to you, verify items, and you have that final interaction with them where they're like, we had to substitute this for that, is this acceptable, you know, just that final sort of interaction is there. But you will have additional jobs that you'll see where regarding the automation that needs to be there. You will need programmers, app developers, those sort of high-skilled jobs nevertheless.
So it doesn't seem as though those robots that are doing some of the stacking is going to completely revolutionize overnight the grocery store industry. One interesting thing, though, that goes into this, and from my mindset, I've been thinking about people who simply order the groceries online and then go pick it up. But delivery has really blown up as well. You know, is this a surprise that we're seeing delivery take off the way that we are?
I think it comes down to the same pool of people. I mean, if it's the convenience you value over anything else, right? Because there's always an upcharge when it comes to delivery. The curbside pickups, they're letting you pick up at the store prices. But if you're trying to get a delivery, the fee is usually at least $10 or more. But again, if you really just didn't want to go out or the weather doesn't permit it, right? Like we're in the Midwest or, you know, people in the South in the summer. I lived in Texas for a while. I would have done anything to not go out in the summer heat to get groceries, including paid, like, of course, the $20 charge. That's perfectly acceptable. Then go out in 100 degrees. So, I mean, it comes down to what are you valuing? If you're valuing convenience and time saving, this is the way to go.
We are talking to Valerie Chandna right now. She's an assistant professor of management for the Austin E. Coffrin School of Business at UW Green Bay. We're discussing grocery shopping habits and who's using new methods such as buying groceries online or having them delivered.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have your grocery shopping habits changed? Have you tried online ordering or delivery? Have you used a subscription box meal service? Do you still shop somewhere that's locally owned and filled with familiar faces? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Right now, we're picking up the conversation about how you grocery shop, whether you shop a few stores to get your favorite items or just order it all online from an app. We're talking with Valerie Chandna right now. She's an assistant professor of management for the Austin E. Coffrin School of Business at UW Green Bay.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you enjoying stores that offer hot meal bars, in-house sushi, or maybe even the chance to have a glass of wine while you shop? Do you like to order online and have the grocery shopping taken care of by someone else? Do you shop at a grocery store where the employees know you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Now, Valerie, as we just heard, we've been talking about the sort of convenience aspect that's available for grocery shoppers, but it also looks as though grocery stores are still trying to get people in through the door. Some places have sushi bars, as we just heard, salad bars, now just bars with beer and wine that you can take with you while you shop. First, what kind of consumer is that appealing to?
Again, if you have the, I mean, I know I'm kind of repeating myself at times, but it comes down to time versus money. If you have time and you don't mind taking, you know, your own sweet time, doing the shopping, enjoying that social aspect of it, you know, you go into the store and you want to do that. I'll just, my own preference is to do online shopping, but my husband likes to do the in-store thing. He's like, oh, it just, you know, it's something that takes my mind off, you know, major things. I can be relaxed, think about nothing while I shop, you know. So if you enjoy that social component or the just all of the, you know, the textures, the sights, the sounds, you do want to go to the store. I mean, and if you're doing it as a couple, again, you might want to just hang out, have a drink, do some shopping, grab dinner after you're done at the sushi bar, like you said, and this, you know, chore becomes like a fun evening out.
So what, it's funny that you mentioned that because some people do think of it as a chore. I knew someone that used to say that going grocery shopping was like taking herself out on a date, which I always thought was very funny. People have different approaches to how they go grocery shopping. I don't want to sound terribly cynical, though, but, you know, isn't the game plan for grocery stores, if they can get you in through the door, that you'll ultimately spend more money in the store?
Exactly. And that is what they do want you to do, that impulse buying, which might be sort of curtailed with an online shopping experience. You might buy precisely what you need, right? But if you're in there, you're picking one item and you see another three that you want. Their aisles are structured in a way whereas you don't grab just a few things and leave. You do have to wander around, walk through different areas and end up grabbing more things than you intended to buy. I mean, it's just how marketing works. That's how they're structured. So they do want you in. They do want you to come spend time at that sushi bar. Or, you know, if you're thinking, oh, you know, dinner can just be picked up at the end here, I can spend an hour and a half shopping instead of 20 minutes because I don't have to go home and pick make dinner. I can just pick it here when I'm done. So they want you to spend more time, of course. So the online is only if you're refusing to come in and are going to go, if you're going the Amazon way or you're going to some other website, they'd rather you came to their store. But if you're coming to the store, that's what they actually want.
So I want to go to our callers right now. We have Deb in Cross Plains. Hi, Deb. What do you want to say?
Hi. Well, I am an early adopter of online grocery shopping. I've been doing it for almost 15 years now, and it was absolutely a life changer. I can't imagine ever going back into a store.
So, Deb, quick question. How did it first get onto your radar that you could go grocery shopping online if you've been doing it for 15 years?
I started when I lived in Chicago, so bigger market, and there was an early online delivery service there, Peapod, that was kind of one of the pioneers in this, and, you know, just through their advertising and marketing, I had a new baby at home at the time and was a working mom, and I was looking for anything that would be a time saver, and once I eliminated grocery shopping from our schedule, you know, I would never want to go back to losing that 4 hours a week on that task.
So I'm guessing you're not wanting to get involved in the wine or beer bars at a grocery store, right, Deb?
Nope, I'd rather go someplace else for my wine and beer.
Well, Deb, thank you so much for that call. And Valerie, going to what Deb was talking about, she was an early adopter, got in kind of on the ground floor with a startup even in Chicago, in a city. And she kind of marks all of those things, busy mom, wouldn't change it for the world. You know, the thing that really struck me about that was just the fact that, you know, she was originally in a larger setting. Are we seeing sort of a trickle down from an urban setting to smaller cities that are adopting this?
I think you're spot on with that. I mean, the adoptions were definitely, you know, Chicago, New York. When I was in Texas about 10 years ago, online, these curbside pickups were already there, well established. So I think now we're seeing where it makes a financial sense for these stores because they've got the logistics set up to start branching inwards and make sure that all markets are taken care of. I think at this point, any of the grocery stores that already have the space for curbside pickup are tending to adopt it faster versus if a store needs to do additional construction or add a warehouse or things like that, they'll be a little slower. But other than that, if the store is a new construction or the store has enough space, they're adopting it in rural areas as well.
So, you know, we've been talking about convenience. We've been talking about kind of the fun aspect of going in if you want different amenities. Some people are also guided by the fact that they, some ideological preferences, they might, we had a caller call in who couldn't stay on the air that said that they liked shopping at a local chain that is employee owned. Some people like going to smaller grocery stores. Are we seeing also a resurgence of smaller brick and mortar areas that appeal to that audience?
I think it's true. And again, this is not necessarily an age-specific thing. A lot of people feel that, yes, we need to support local. And this could even be young millennial shoppers or Gen Z shoppers who feel like, no, I want the more personalized or the more local experience rather than a big chain. So you do have people who want that component of, yes, I'm supporting local, I'm supporting small. It doesn't matter if I didn't have 20 cereals to choose from and just have two cereal boxes that I have to opt between. But at least I'm helping a local business. So you are right. There is a resurgence of trying to support businesses near you that you care about.
Darlene on Facebook has used a new technology that some stores are testing out in Wisconsin. She uses Sam's Club's scan and go system where the customer downloads an app. It allows them to just scan the items in their cart as they shop. And when they're done, they pay their total on the app and they just show proof of purchase and then they walk out. It seems as though more and more of the convenience is there. We've seen that also with some of the Amazon stores that have opened that they just scan it and they leave. Are we going to get to a point, too, where it's just so short that maybe, I don't know, a store might anticipate what we want?
I think the example you raise about Amazon is an interesting one because they don't even scan. You actually just walk in. They've got all these sensors that sort of pick up on what you're adding to your cart. I mean, that store is like the entire ceiling is pretty much covered in sensors, and the floor has sensors, and there's just sensors everywhere at the Amazon Go store that they're trying out. They've only erred, I believe, in a customer-favored manner, in the sense that you may not be charged for an item, but you never get double charged, or you never get charged for something you didn't pick. So it is interesting that you have this facility available, or this automation possible, where you could just go and grab items and leave, or go and scan items and leave. But I think there is a point where it may not be as cost effective for all stores to adopt this. For some stores, yes, it'll definitely make sense. It's almost a version of the self-checkout in a way, that you're scanning as you go. So you are doing the checkout process yourself. It's just that rather than at the end point, you're doing it during the process. So some people might prefer that. I had a colleague joke that, oh, they're still making us do the work. So there's that perspective as well. But yeah.
So as someone who looks at this pretty broadly, you said that internationally things are changing as well. You know, in the long term, if you had to forecast, you know, cost versus, you know, impact, all that, what are you thinking that we might see more of moving forward?
I think you've seen countries that have sort of pioneered this in a way, like South Korea has. I mean, and a lot of people keep looking at Europe versus US and looking at those statistics. But South Korea, actually, because they have the fastest internet in the world and the greatest broadband penetration in their country, almost all public spaces have free Wi-Fi, have started seeing people use grocery shopping. Almost 25% of their population does their grocery shopping online. But for us, the growth is going to be, like I said, there's going to be like a spurt of growth that we're going to see now as more and more stores adopt this. They're going to have to find sort of the balance of what is it the customers want the most? Is it the click and save? Is that working the best? Is the personal shopper working the best? Is it just digital coupons and online, you know, list creation? Do they just want, you know, Google Map type aisle mapping so people can, you know, figure out which aisle they want to go to? So a lot of different ways this can go. But I think definitely a growth spurt the next decade or so.
In the last, you know, 10 seconds, how do you balance you wanting to online shop and your husband wanting to go into the store?
Most of the time, I guess it depends on who's in charge. So I do a lot of the curbside pickups. It also helps with if it's multiple stores. So my husband will go to one store physically in person himself. And then if I still want a few items from another
store. I'm going to have to cut you off, Valerie. But thank you so much for joining us today. Valerie Chandna is an assistant professor of management for the Austin E. Coffrin School of Business at UW Green Bay. She joined us to talk about the evolution of grocery shopping.
We did a segment yesterday about PBS painting teacher Bob Ross and why some are saying he deserves a lot more respect in the art world.
And there was a lot of Bob Ross love on Facebook. Teresa Catherine shared, after a stressful day, I love coming home and turning on Netflix to watch him. I love him so much that I even got one of his trees tattooed on me.
That's awesome. Stephen added to that comment that Bob would say, and we will put another tree next to that one because everybody needs a friend. And he says that Bob really got to him with that.
I think that's really sweet. Wayne said online, Bob has done an amazing job of demystifying the art of painting. I have to wonder how many people that were insecure about giving it a try wound up doing so because of him.
Lisa said, he taught me a lot of painting techniques via TV. Love him. Glad to see his shows are making a comeback.
And, you know, Brandy said it's like watching, or it's meditative almost. So a lot of interesting responses
really,
to this.
Really wonderful, heartwarming. And, you know, maybe there is more of a market for Bob Ross paintings out there.
I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Well, coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then we'll talk about the cost of emotional labor in the workplace. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.